This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I've structured our section of the discussion around a series of questions that I thought would be productive to get the discussion going and get us all on the same page with some of the issues that Hans Hacke's work brings to the foreground. Now, Hans, a lot of your work features juxtapositions. Some of these, such as the piece that you have here on the screen, the Bowery Seeds project, some of these juxtapositions bring together what could be called ephemeral juxtapositions, something that involves a degree of chance and other contingencies. And other pieces focus on other pieces foreground juxtapositions of political and social issues related to the particular site. For instance, the MoMA poll of 1970, I believe, or Germania at the Venice Biennale. And then there are works that make deliberate juxtapositions, such as the museum work, such as Viewing Matters at the Rotterdam's Boijmans Museum, I believe it's called, and the Mixed Messages piece at London Serpentine Gallery. That these are more recent works, or at least works in the last decade and a half. So I want to ask you about the role of juxtaposition, the role that juxtaposition plays in your art, putting things together, arranging different elements. And I know you've prepared a slide PowerPoint presentation. You know, it's probably a good idea to start off with you going through some of these images, some of these works, so that we have an image vocabulary of artworks that we can relate back to, and that we can all know, at least have in our minds as we continue the conversation. So if it's okay with you, instead of waiting for later, maybe it's a good idea to start off with you going through a series of works. You have something like 10 different artworks, and if you don't mind, okay, starting off by going through an overview of some of these artworks that then we can bring back into the discussion. Now, I must say that you should know we discussed what artworks might be in this PowerPoint presentation, so it's not ephemeral. There's not that much chance that has entered into the selection of artworks, but it's probably a good idea if we start off with this, if that's okay with you.
Okay, let me start off thanking Aaron for his introduction and inviting me here, and also Alex to join me in this discussion. I have, as Alex said, images of about 10 works, or maybe even a little less, several images for many of them. I will be very brief in the introduction of these works, because otherwise our time is up in no time, and we can then come back to them in our discussion.
That's good.
The first image that you see here is something that is truly ephemeral, namely my dumping a pile of soil on the roof of the building where I had a studio. Right now, for those of you who know New York a little bit, this is the second floor of Whole Foods at the corner of the Bowery and East Houston Street. And in effect, it's very simple. You see a tar paper roof, And as the title explains, burrowy seeds means that these are airborne seeds that settled there and sprouted, and I didn't do anything to it. This and the following image, they are related, is something that goes out of the Bowery and into an art space, even though you don't see it there. In effect, I introduced instruments into an art space that are not foreign to art spaces, even though we pay no attention to them. This is a thermograph and a barograph and a hygrograph, and I recorded the climate in this art exhibition. And here you see one of the charts that were produced in 1970 when I did that. More pointed, perhaps, is my contribution to an exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art in 1970. The show had the provocative title Information, and I used this opportunity to produce information with the result that I have not been invited to the Modern for decades. This is a jump in time to 1988. In Graz, Austria, the major city in the south of Austria, where in 1938, 50 years earlier, the Nazis had a major rally celebrating their takeover, their annexation, as it is normally referred to. But they thought of it differently. They called this event, "And You Were Victorious After All." That refers to a Nazi putsch in Vienna a couple of years earlier that failed. And in the center of Graz, a major square, they built this obelisk, and underneath that obelisk, here is a photograph of the same square in 1988. There is a column with a statue of the Virgin Mary on top. So it's quite a shift. And I use this to comment on the history of Graz. And rebuilt this column with an inscription of those who were vanquished at the time. And I gave a listing of the Jews killed at the time from Graz, of the soldiers from the region that were that didn't survive the war, of political prisoners who died in detention, etc. And towards the end of the show, before the end, the this reconstruction was firebombed. Here you see people in Graz gathering around it, discussing what happened. And one of the things that also happened was that the statue of the Virgin Mary on top melted. There is a new one right now. This is again in another European city. This is in Venice in 1940, I believe. It was the German pavilion had been taken over by the Nazis, of course. They had restyle the architecture. It used to be a sort of a Rococo-style building for Bavarian art. They streamlined it, and here you have a view into the pavilion with a statue of Breaker with the title Being Prepared at the far end of the pavilion. And above the entrance, if you look carefully, you'll see a portion of the swastika and the eagle. This is the restyled pavilion from the Nazis, but I am introducing you to what I added to it. Here's a close-up. Above the entrance, I put the new logo of the reunited Germany. This was 1993. The one thing that the Germans, both East and West, were almost emotionally allied to was the power of the German mark. Otherwise, they were only celebrating a World Soccer Championship victory. And approaching the entrance, I put a commemorative photograph of 1934. This was the first foreign visit of Hitler in Italy, in Venice, visiting his buddy Mussolini, and being taken around in the then German pavilion, and it was at that time that he decided that this is no longer the style of the new Reich. It had to be restyled and became what I showed you earlier of the facade. And I sort of drew what you may call the bottom line after the reunification and everything that led up to it or needed to be done. And it was an accounting of many decades of German history. And so this was my accounting. The floor that had been put there to support Arno Breaker was broken up, and the inscription on the facade was repeated in the back. This is Germany. And one more thing dealing with German history. When after the reunification of Germany, the government decided to move its site, its location from Bonn to Berlin, where the former German capital, which is now again the German capital. The Reichstag building that housed the German parliament was bombed, and it was reconstructed. Norman Foster was the architect to do this. And a number of artists from various countries, and predominantly, however, from it was the four occupation powers. One artist from each of those countries was invited, plus a German artist of a certain generation, to produce a permanent installation in the space, in the refurbished building. And I focused on what had been bothering me for quite some while, particularly after during a visit in Berlin in 1984 when I did a show there, namely the inscription on the facade of the building, Dem Deutschen Volker, which translated sounds rather innocent to the German people, due to German history since the takeover of the Nazis, the term Volk, people, and the qualifier German had taken on very sinister connotations, and I wanted to put this into context. And so my proposal was to dedicate or rededicate or put the dedication of the building that was on the facade into perspective. And I proposed to have in the same typeface a new dedication, namely to the population. And I was inspired by Bertolt Brecht to do that, and it became a major national debate. I don't want to go into the details. And it was so big that there was a parliamentary debate and a vote, and it had riled the media to the extent that it was brought on the news, the national news, after the vote. And here you see the announcer. And here there's a picture of the debate. And here's one of the opponents of my proposal, who is now the president of the German parliament. And here one of the supporters, a member from Nuremberg, who, as I had proposed, brought from her constituency 100 pounds of soil to be spread around the dedication, with the understanding that no gardening, no nothing, be done to it. And it turned into a wild growth of imported seeds. There's a connection to the Bowery and Whole Foods and so forth. And this is an image, a photograph from the roof. It's open air into the courtyard from 2008. And among the flowers there is this little blue flower, of which I shot a close-up. Then in 2001 in the fall, to be produced by Creative Arts in New York, I was invited together with others to make proposals for a commemoration of 9/11. And I proposed, and it was executed according to my proposal, to have a silhouette, a poster, out of which the silhouette of the World Trade Center towers was cut out, over pasted over posters whose time the paid time had run out. This is my proposal, and here is one of many hundred shots of these posters in situ. Another one here on a scaffolding being ripped down. This is a shot into an exhibition that I produced at the Boijmans van Beuningen Museum in Rotterdam with the collection. I pulled things out from the basement, and there are many aspects to this, very complicated. Part of this was that here you see the founder, or the man after whom the name of the museum was styled, Mr. van Beuningen, a statue of his on a lorry. Behind him on the wall is one of the first major, literally speaking, capitalists of Holland. Holland was had the first stock exchange of the world, and was a major colonizer, as you know, and a major trades country, and also went to war with the British, among others. Left and right, two prints by Marcel Brochards on Capital. These are, and on the opposite, there's a version of the juxtaposition. On the opposite side of the wall, there's the oil drum of Bertrand Lavier and an old Dutch painting with the Dutch fleet ready to shoot at the British. The simple folks coming out of the sea and the gentry to the left and receiving homage from the simple folks. And this is here in Philadelphia, in a way, that is to say, my tribute to Ken Lum, in the exhibition in Rotterdam. I juxtaposed his Millie Shum Hates Her Job with a painting representing Napoleon in regal attire. And I made a number of just, this is from a book that was made of the exhibition. Another juxtaposition there was an Andy Warhol in the background, the little dancer of Degas facing a giant Rodin figure, a headless figure. And here you see the juxtaposition or confrontation from a different angle. And behind her were images that are found in the collection of women, and on the opposite side of men. And here another connection with Philadelphia. This is Andrea Fraser guiding visitors through the Philadelphia Museum of Art. In the background, landscapes from the collection of the Dutch Museum. This is a jump to London, as I did in Rotterdam. I was invited to produce an exhibition at the Serpentine Gallery, which is just maybe half a mile away from the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, with works that I would select from the collection of the V&A. This is the central space of the Serpentine. I had the Dying Slave, a replica of the Dying Slave of Michelangelo, in the center. On the left side there, on the wall, against the wall, you see a Buddha from Burma. On the other wall, Turkish prayer rugs. And seen from the other side, there is a crucifix and a Torah mantle. And in one of the showcases that I put together, I had images of black people as they appear either in artworks or in toys of various ages. And one of them was a very, very strange juxtaposition taken from almost literally as it is displayed here, taken from the Museum of Childhood at Bethnal Green in London, which is part of the V&A. It's called an exchange doll. with a black male face and a female children's head and interchangeable limbs. This, in effect, became this photograph became then a wall size, the entrance to an exhibition in Berlin.
So as you're going, through the series of works, I was noting that there, we can divide. I mean, in the most general sense, the types of juxtapositions into the ephemeral juxtapositions, such as the Bowery piece that you showed, then the deliberate juxtapositions of the MoMA poll and others, where there's a juxtaposition of the social and the political, and to a certain extent the economic issues. With Gras's piece, or the Germania at the Venice Biennale, or in Graz, Austria, it's a kind of temporal juxtaposition. The past and the present is what is in play, even though, well, I suppose, even though there are many other dimensions going on so far as the Virgin Mary enters into the work. But I think that essentially that's a temporal play of juxtaposition. And then with the museum collection, it's a kind of juxtaposition of elements of an archive, a juxtaposition of what's on display and what's in storage, what's not on display. So clearly, it's not an indiscriminate display of unrelated objects that you're after with these juxtapositions. So then the question is, you know, what is it that you're seeking to try to put together with these juxtapositions? Is it a creative friction in the surrealist sense of the l'autrement sense of the of juxtaposing normally unrelated objects or things that drives these juxtapositions, or is it dream work? What is the underlying logic of I won't say montages, but the juxtapositions that you're playing with?
Well,
and of course, they're very different in different cases. But is there something that underlies this half a century long practice of seeking juxtapositions?
You mentioned the name L'Autre Amont, and of course, L'Autre Amont was a hero of the surrealists, and it was in fact something that he was supposed to have said. Or was it the surrealist who spoke about the ironing board and
they recording?
Yeah. The ironing board and
an umbrella
on an operating table as an example or an image or an instruction to produce a new meaning out of common objects that everybody is familiar with. I made that reference in my introduction in a text to the exhibition in London, and also, I believe, referred to it in a catalog text for the exhibition in Rotterdam. And in effect, I believe if one brings things together, and for that matter, not only the surrealists, of course, also the Dadaists did this.
You have to put that back.
The collage is such a juxtaposition.
Let me just fix this here. Sorry, Lance.
You ride on the one hand on the original meanings of your material. At the same time, you produce new materials, and it is the friction between the two that is productive.
How would that work, for instance, with the Bowery Seeds piece that you showed? What kind of friction are we talking about that might be productive? That's not going to work the way you have it set it up.
You think it works?
You know, I'm so unfamiliar with this particular device. Try this. Just try talking out of one side of your mouth.
I believe the Bowery piece is somewhat different. It is more the location and the type of planting that we associate with gardening versus this wild growth that I triggered. I believe that is a different caliber, but...
Okay, but that enters into some of the later pieces that you showed us, for instance, in Berlin, or...
Yes.
You
know, it is certainly chance, which is also a data medium, so to speak, that enters into...
So is chance something that... I know that Duchamp is somebody who you've been interested in for a long time, right?
Yeah.
Is chance something that drives the logic of your work? One tends to think of your work more I rarely think of chance as entering into the operation of what you set in play in an institution. Of course, with some of these pieces, that's what it is. If it's seeds landing on Earth. But to what degree does chance enter into your production process?
Of course, I rig the situation. I set up something. Normally, there's no plant growing on a roof in that neighborhood. So I set up the stage. I provided some, but not the whole. And in Berlin with the Reichstag, I gave, so to speak, the rules of the game. But how it then is played out, that's where chance enters into the game. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, we structured the evening around this issue of specificity and site specificity in particular, and I think that it's probably a good idea to start with some kind of working definition. And site specificity is basically a method of artistic production where different materials and techniques are employed in the production of the artwork itself. And those materials and techniques that are employed in the production of the artwork aren't only dependent on the specific conditions upon which the artwork's created, but also often contingent on particular requirements of the work, particular requirements that the work has to meet in what is, in each case, a different situation. So my question then would be, to what extent do references to the particular institutional location or social situation in which your artwork is displayed play a role in that work's logic or composition, if you will?
Well, in many or all of the examples that I showed, the architectural conditions of the space, but in many instances also the social specifics of the space, the history of the space, who is in charge, who runs it or did run it, and for what purposes come into play. They are part of the material with which I'm working. And that can be very tricky, and other times it is a welcoming environment. It depends on the situation.
A lot of your work, much of your, artistic practice developed within the context of frames. Your first book, was that your first book? What was the title of the Nascat book?
Framing and Being Framed.
Was that your first? Was that
no,
what
no,
we could
no.
call it? Well, okay,
well,
one of your first books.
As far as my own active editing is concerned, that was the first.
Yeah, it's certainly the first book of yours that I know of. And Framing and Being Framed. So a lot of your practice, which was from the mid-70s, right? I think Edward Fry
75.
Was involved in this. A lot of your practice developed within the context not only of an analysis of frames operative in the art world, but within the context of a demystification of frames, a context that sought to explode altogether the idea that the gallery or museum were neutral frames. And certainly it's clear that an account of the operation of the exhibition context had a great impact on your artistic production from the early 1960s on. What's also evident is that there's a shift in the parameters of that account in the late 1960s, probably 1969, 1970. MoMA poll would be one of the first, but I think already in 69 one can detect a shift in the parameters of your exploration of frames when your work begins to move from an exploration of physical and biological frames to one of social and political frames, perhaps, economic frames, certainly. What led to that shift? Can we just spend a moment on, you know, articulating? First of all, I'd like you to agree with me that there is this shift that takes place.
Oh, yeah,
and then secondly, articulating what was it that prompted the social dimension, the move Ludwig von Bertalanffy social and biological systems to sociological systems, social systems, to an exploration of social systems. What was it that produced that shift, that fundamental shift?
Well, I belong to the generation that politicized during the late 60s. In this country, it was the Vietnam War that played a decisive role. I also remember that I had been invited to give a talk on my work in New York at some occasion, and a week before the date of that talk, Martin Luther King was assassinated, and my introduction to my talk about these biological and physical systems, as I called them then, was that they cannot do justice what we just experienced in the social arena, and certainly that and the Vietnam War in this country contributed to my shifting my emphasis. But of course, in 1968, also in Europe, major changes took place. The revolution in Paris that then spread to Berlin and, for that matter, to Columbia University and Berkeley, et cetera, in this country. It was a cultural revolution and, in part, a rather decisive shift in political attitudes. And that, in turn, had the effect that in 1969, triggered by the visit of a Greek artist based in Paris, Vasilakis Takis, that artists in New York banded together under the heading of what became the so-called Art Workers Coalition, a group of artists of my generation and younger than myself, who became aware that artworks and the institutions in which they were admitted, depending on whether they were already had some credibility among the established art historians and curators and so forth, that these institutions were not neutral as they normally are perceived. And we recognize that the trustees of the Museum of Modern Art, among many other museums, of course, were in one fashion or another related to the government that was running the Vietnam War, and we began to challenge the institutions.
Can I just say something, which is that I just want to go back to something you said a few minutes ago, which is that you came to the realization that the biological and physical systems that you were working with couldn't do justice to the situation, almost implying, I think, on your part, that it was the biological systems that you were exploring or the physical systems, but not what I think was really what was being explored, which was the systems themselves, the circuits.
Yeah.
An exploration of systems theory, because that's really what we're talking about, systems theory, as it was being theorized at MIT and places like that at that moment. So it wasn't really about biological systems. The work in the 60s was about systems and how things are connected. So that shift that you're talking about to move away from non-social, it seems to me, non-social systems to social systems seems to not take into account that it's still an exploration of systems. I mentioned this because today, obviously, we're circuits and networks and information systems or systems in general is something that is very much part of our culture, regardless of whether it's social systems or whatever kinds of systems. Yeah. It's the interconnectivity.
Yeah.
So, given that it wasn't just moving from non-social to social, it was
expanding into the social. That might be
okay. I mean, one thing that a lot of people tend to forget, I think, is that the social for art in the 1960s to deal with social issues was seen as not art. Was seen as, today it's very difficult to grasp that because that's a paradigm that's lost or that's no longer necessarily present, even though it's probably more present than we think. But let's move on here. One could argue that the operation of the gallery museum complex is intricately related to the operation of the artist's studio context, that the gallery museum context and the artist studio context are intricately related. Certainly for someone like Daniel Buren, for instance, to question the function of one of these sites, either the artist studio or the exhibition context, and not the other, to question one of those sites and not the other, that is to question the function of the gallery museum context and not that of the studio, is folly, is an error. So, because they're so interconnected. The studio, as Buren argues several places, most specifically in the essay The Function of the Studio, isn't only a private space that's presided over by the artist, like this private space of contemplation and production for the artist, but it's also a site where the exhibition curator or the gallery operator, to a certain extent, the critic can go into and calmly, for at least the first two, the exhibition curator, the gallery organizer, calmly choose among the artworks that have already been created in that site by the artist to be included in this or that show, in this or that collection, in this or that gallery. So my question here is, to what extent you think that this increasing awareness of the function of the studio led to an interest in site-specific art practices that greatly diminished the role of the studio? It was at the same moment that site-specific art practices begin to proliferate, I guess we could say, that one has a parallel discussion of post-studio practice. So to what extent is a site-specific practice a critique of the studio or a reflection on the operation of the studio?
Well, in my case, and this is not necessarily typical, I did not view it as leaving the studio and going somewhere else. It evolved out of circumstances, it is already for quite some while now very touching in a way when writers or critics or whoever is interested in my work, they want to come to my studio. And I said, well, I don't have a studio. You can come to where I have my computer at home and where I'm working, but there is not the haphazard stuff sitting around that you could look at and contemplate and be in a physical contact with. There is no such thing. But in effect, in a number of instances, of course, things need to be produced, but I do not have produced in a physical sense objects or situations that require to import something into a given space. And the skills required to produce them and the material wherewithal, the machinery or whatever is required, I don't have, nor would it be worthwhile it would make no economic sense, and for me to learn all these techniques would also be ridiculous. I'm trying very hard to be good at Photoshop and a few other such things, but I often go to people who know more about it, and they, under my direction or with my direction, they then produce what I need to import into the specific locations, sites, circumstances in which I want to address a public.
Let me. Can I just push this a bit to another register here? Because this is interesting, and it's something that I think it's still relatively unclear, not just in your practice, but in a lot of contemporary practice. Now, taking the idea that I just mentioned of this idea about the intricate relationship between the function of the studio and the function of the gallery museum context a bit further, for somebody like Buren, for instance, since I've already mentioned him, Buren argued that the studio and the particular types of objects that are produced there and under the conditions of the studio is fundamental to the regular production, exhibition, and distribution of art objects. And therefore, to disrupt the operation of the artist's studio through the development of site-specific art, or what he calls in situ art, to disrupt the operation of the artist's studio is to disrupt the conventional operation of the art world. To disrupt the studio is to kind of break the whole, to break the circuit, and to come back to this discussion of circuits that we were having a second ago. But your work seems to take a somewhat opposite view from what you're saying here. Or better put, your work approaches the same issue, but from a different angle, because you seem to put a lot of pressure on the ways in which the spaces of exhibition, the spaces of display, structure what is or can be shown in them. In other words, if Buren argues that the logic of the artist's studio, a place where, I mean, for Buren, the artist's studio is a place where portable objects are produced, right? It's a space where portable objects are made that can then freely circulate in the into spaces other than where they were made. It's a space where the whole commodity structure of the art world starts, because it's where the portable is made. And once you start to make portable objects that then can go live somewhere where they weren't made, you have the art world as it has come to be structured. So that if Buren argues that the logic of the artist studio structures or overdetermines, if you will, the nature of what's conventionally considered to be an artwork, how correct do you think that it would be for me to suggest that, from your perspective, it's the museum or gallery space, the space of exhibition, and to a large extent, the space of distribution, that is the primary force in determining the type of art objects that are made, in determining what can come up for the count as an artwork in the culture? So not the studio, but the exhibition space that structures what is produced and what circulates.
Well, I would take a step back in my attempt to answer your question. A long time ago, in the early 70s, I wrote a piece in which I spoke about what determines what is viewed as an artwork. What is art? And
do you remember the title of the piece? Okay, doesn't matter.
It was written in 74 for a catalog.
Okay.
And I came up with the conclusion, based on my personal experience but also looking around, that in effect the definition of what is an artwork is a social consensus, and it depends who the powerful figures in this particular field, and I'm now using a Bourdieu term, the field, which could also be substituted by the art system as a term, what the powerful figures at a given moment determine as something to be viewed under the auspices of art and giving their blessing to it. Without that blessing, whether this work is done in the studio or is done outside, it is not considered a work of art, and every period has its own arguments over whether this is still art or whether it has anything to do with art or it should be understood as who knows what. And so when Daniel Buren started off working and made these references, that was a challenge to the generally accepted notions of art. And I don't believe it was really tied to the studio. It was more general or more fundamental a challenge. But time takes care of things. He then eventually became a very well-known French artist, was invited for retrospectives at the Pompidou, and got all the blessings of the art world, the official and the less official one. And this is... The power mongers in the art world, and they depend on where you are and at what time, agree that this is art, well, then it is art. And the same is true for my stuff. I'm not exempt from this strange and fascinating social process.
Okay.
The fact that, that I'm here, that you're an art historian, that we talk about it under the auspices of art, is in a way proof to the what I'm saying.
Okay. Let me try one more question, because these are questions that we can then open up to the audience, and we can discuss further. We're covering quite a bit of quite a few different issues here. But let me try one last question. Let me end by saying that one of the aspects of your artwork that I've always greatly admired, and is that even when your work reflects on the operating logic of museums or galleries, or on the instrumentalization that we could call it the increasing instrumentalization of the art world by political and economic interests, even when your work reflects on these dimensions, it isn't pessimistic. I mean, there seems to be an underlying belief evident in all of your work, all of the work that I know of, at least, that if there seems to be an underlying belief that if the internal contradictions and the inconsistencies of the art world can be exposed, plainly exposed for all to see, if the intersections where aesthetic, political, economic and ideological interests can be publicly revealed, then the public function of art could once again be regained. To what extent do you agree with this assessment?
Yeah, probably. I mean, there's no question. If I would say no.
This isn't a trick question.
I would have stopped working altogether.
Well, there are plenty of art. There are plenty of.
I had sort of thrown up my hands, and I'm just wallowing in my misery and my disgust with the world, and forget about me, or that I. Produce something that you should be involved in. I've said that before. My being angry is about certain things is a very productive source of energy. Provokes me to get involved, and if one looks at it from a different angle, I would argue this, in a way, is, and I'm not only talking about myself, but society in general. If people do not react with their anger in a manner that is engaging the situation, responding to in a what I would hope a productive manner, then we forget about democracy. Democracy is dependent on the active engagement of every person who can or should vote. That requires input, and I try to do my little thing here. Although when I'm doing it, I'm not thinking in those terms, but in effect, I believe this is part of the social mechanism.
So you're seeing the art world as a form of public speech, or art practice as a
yes,
form of public
yes,
speech?
Yes, yes, yes.
So maybe that this is a good place to stop then. So thank you very much for your discussion.
Thank you. Thank you.